ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय भगवते. We are reading from the 10th canto, chapter 4, text 28 and text 29. So 28 is on the board, right? Yes? So I guess we're going to chant 28. Sri Sukha Uvacha Kaṃsa Evam Prasanabhyam Vishudham Pratibhasita Devaki Vasudevabhyam. Anugyato Anvishad Griham Sri Sukha Uvacha Kamsa Evam Prasanabhyam Vishudham Pratibhangsita Devaki Vasudevabhyam Anugyato Vishadgriham Sri Sukha Uvacha Kaṃsa evam prasanābhyam Vishudham pratibhāsitā Devaki vasudevabhyam Anugyato viśadgriham Śrī sukha uvācha Kaṃsa evam prasanābhyam Vishudham pratibhāsitā Devaki vasudevabhyam Anugyato viśadgriham Pratibhāsitā Ladies. Kamsa evam prasanabhyam Vishudham pratibhasitah Devaki vasudevabhyam anugyato visadgriham sri sugovacha amsevam prasanagyam vishuddham pratibhasitaha devake vasudevabhyam anugyato visadgriham. Word meanings. Sri Suku Uvacha. Sri Sukadev Goswami said, Kangsaha, King Kangsa, Evam, thus, Prasanabhyam, who were very much appeased, Vishuddham, in purity, Pratibhashitaha, being answered, Devaki Vasudevabhyam, by Devaki and Vasudev, Anugyataha, taking permission, Avishat, entered, Griha, his own palace. Translation, Sukadeva Goswami continued, thus, having been addressed in purity by Devaki and Vasudev, who were very much appeased, Kamsa felt pleased, and with their permission, he entered his home. So today's verse, why don't I just read today's verse? You can put it up, yes. 29. I'll read the Sanskrit and the translation. Tasya. Wait. I'll just read it myself. I can.
Tasyam ratram vyatithyam kangsa akuya mantrinaha tebya achashtatat sharvam yaruktam yoga nidraya.
After that night passed, Kangsa summoned his ministers and informed them of all that had been spoken by Yogamaya, who had revealed that he was to slay Kangsa, who had revealed that he who was to slay Kangsa had already been born somewhere else. Purport. The Vedic scripture Chandi describes Maya, the energy of the Supreme Lord, as Nidra. Durga Devi Sarvam Bhuteshu Nidra Rupeni Nidra Rupena Samastitaha. The energy of Yoga Maya and Maha Maya keeps the living entities sleeping in this material world in the great darkness of ignorance. Yoga Maya, the goddess Durga, kept Kamsa in darkness about Krishna's birth and misled him to believe that his enemy Krishna had been born elsewhere. Krishna was born the son of Devaki, but according to the Lord's original plan, prophesied to Brahma, he went to Vrindavan to give pleasure to Mother Yasoda and Nanda Maharaj and other intimate friends and devotees for 11 years. Then he would return to kill Kamsa. Because Kamsa did not know this, he believed Yogamaya's statement that Krishna was born elsewhere, not of Devaki. So, I found this interesting because what Prabhupada is saying is that Yogamaya is lying to Kamsa to protect herself in a sense, or just to calm him down, that look at the person who's going to kill you, it's not me and it's not born of Devaki, so don't worry about them. But actually she wasn't lying, because she said the person who's going to kill you was born elsewhere, and it's true. He was born elsewhere. So, Yogamaya is Krishna's younger sister, right? Subhadra. So how is she his younger sister? She had to be born of the same mother. So earlier in this chapter, it's kind of interesting, in two places that I know of, in this chapter, verse 10, and the previous chapter, verse 47, in the purport, Prabhupada explains that Krishna was born simultaneously in Mathura and in Vrindavan, both as the son of Devaki and as the son of Yashoda. So she wasn't lying. And many of you know the story, but in Krishna book it's not told, but it's told in the Bhagavatam, but sometimes you don't realize it's told because it's not in the verse, it's in the purport. And it's Vishwanath Chakravarti giving an explanation, which is from a book called Harivamsa, and Harivamsa also talks about Krishna's birth, and there it is said that actually he was born of Yashoda, and his younger sister is Yogamaya or Subhadra. They were twins. But simultaneously, he was born as the son of Devaki. And when Krishna was brought to Vrindavan, then that Vasudev Krishna merged into Shyamasundara Krishna in Vrindavan. So Krishna then was able to satisfy Devaki and Vasudev to become their son, because that's what they wanted, and also simultaneously became the son of Yashoda, by birth, actually. Yes, you know that? Yeah, anyway, sometimes I tell devotees this, maybe younger devotees, and they've never heard it. And it's right here in the purport. If you go back to verse 10, it's in the purport. And if you go back to the previous chapter, I think it's verse 47 or 48, it's there. And so it's an explanation by Vishwanath Chakravarti. You know. So she actually wasn't lying when she said, "Your enemy has been born elsewhere." It's true. I mean, in a sense, she was lying. I want to go back to the first verse we were reading, verse 27. No, excuse me. It's verse 28. And it said here, "Thus having been addressed in purity by Devaki and Vasudev, who were very much appeased, Kamsa felt pleased, and with their permission he entered his home." So why was he appeased? Well, they had an interesting conversation, and you've been discussing this in class, but I found this conversation interesting because Kamsa said something that didn't seem right, or at least it didn't seem proper. It didn't seem that he was showing proper respect to his sister. He said, "I'm sorry that I killed your children, but actually it's your karma." Which, you know, generally would not be a nice thing to say after you kill eight children of your sister. "Actually, it's just your karma. It had to happen." And so we say, if you commit a sinful activity, you're responsible, right? And you can't just tell the other person, "Well, actually, it was just your karma, so I'm innocent." But the interesting thing is, in the purport, Prabhupada said, Kamsa was right. It was her karma. Because if you know the story, these eight sons were meant to take birth. It was a curse. And anyway, they were meant to take birth. And they were benedicted that they wouldn't have to live. Only one would have to live. But these seven sons, eight of them, one would have to live. And seven got the benediction when they were cursed to take birth on earth that they would be killed when they were born. So it actually was divine arrangement anyway. But aside from that, Prabhupada makes the point, whatever happens to you is your karma. So if somebody punches you in the face and says, "It's your karma," you can't say, "No, it's not," because everything that happens to you is. Right? Now, you may not like your karma. You may not like the person who delivers your karma. But according to what Prabhupada's saying, it doesn't happen by accident. It is your karma. And so don't blame the messenger of your karma. So that's an interesting point that's being made here. Another interesting point, and this comes up in the Bhagavatam often, is that you find these kings who are by nature asuras, demoniac. They have this demoniac tendency. They're not devotees, but they have Vedic knowledge. So Kamsa was explaining, this is your karma, which means he understands karma. And you'll find in Vedic society, kings were quite cultured. When even demoniac kings, when something unjust would happen, they would say, "This is not just. they wouldn't even agree. And when Brahmins would come, even the kings were demoniac, they would offer. They would offer to the Brahmins what they wanted. They would treat them properly. So there's a culture there. So even it's interesting, because even though these kings were Asuric by nature, they were within a Vedic culture. So they were acting according to the culture, but they were just Asuric. That was their nature. So what I found interesting here is that here you have Kamsa and he's speaking philosophy, that this is your karma. So just like when you meet somebody, you're distributing books, you're at a college, you're at the temple, and you're speaking to someone, and someone says, I believe in karma, I'm vegetarian, then you think, oh, this person's evolved. This is a good candidate, right? He's hip. He knows what's going on. Well, Kamsa knew what was going on also, right? Is Kamsa a good candidate for Krishna consciousness? Of course not. So he understood, he had knowledge, but he was demoniac. So knowledge is, it's not a solution in and of itself. His nature was demonic. That's just who he was. And there's some people whose nature is not so demoniac, but they're just ignorant. Their actual nature is very good, but they're in ignorance. So they have to be guided. So knowledge alone, it's not sufficient, right? Yeah, I know about karma. I believe in karma, this and that. Yeah, and your very nature is Kamsa's nature. He's a demon. That's just who he is. His default nature is a demon. When he goes back, he tells his ministers what happens, and his ministers, oh, this is not good. You should kill every child that's taken birth because you don't know where Krishna is. Then Kamsa thinks, well, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. He's a demon. That's his nature. You know, occasionally he gets a sentiment that I've done something wrong, some higher awareness, some forgiveness, some remorse. And then he talks to his associates and so they say, no, this is not good. Don't forgive. And he's like, yeah, you're right. You have a good point there. And then he'll do something atrocious. That's who he is. That's his nature. Some people have that nature. I was in a bookstore and there was a book on Adolf Hitler. So somehow I was attracted. I'm attracted to demons. I don't know why. So I pick up this book, and there's a picture of Adolf Hitler when he's 10 years old. I actually took a picture of it because it's so amazing. And you can tell this person is head to toe, in and out, asura. At 10, you could see it in his face. One time, a doctor came to see Prabhupada. Then Prabhupada said to Tamal Krishna, Maharaj, he said, so what do you think of the doctor? So Tamal Krishna Maharaj said, I'm not a doctor, Prabhupada, I don't know. Prabhupada said, you saw his face. What do you think by seeing his face? Does he look like a truthful, honest person? So this face of Hitler, like some, I show it to devotees, I say, who do you think this is? It's a 10-year-old boy. And they keep guessing, and after a while, everybody gets it. That's Hitler. There's nobody has that countenance at the age of 10. So some people have that nature. They can't be changed. It's just who they are. So that's Kamsa's nature. So I found that interesting, that he could have knowledge, but it didn't really do anything. Just like we may know something. We may know so many things. Does it mean we're going to do what we know? No. Right? What are you going to do? Are you going to do what you know? Not necessarily. You know, have you ever said, I know I should, but? Anyone ever said that? And then you feel in after the but, the reason you're not going to do it? So according to Three Modes of Nature, that is a textbook example of tamaguna. I know I should, but. Because Prabhupada says tamaguna means it doesn't go beyond dreaming. You know, you have the idea, but that's about it. It's not activated. I know I should, but it's too much trouble. So we may know so many things. That's not sufficient. And when you come to the mode of passion, you'll only do it if it makes you feel good. Yeah, I know I should do it, but I don't feel like it. Mode of ignorance is like, is not even the question if I like it or not. It's just too much trouble. It's too austere. It's like, you tell somebody, you know, you should get up at 4 o'clock, and they make a face. You know, it's like, they don't even think they like it or not. It's just beyond even liking or not liking. So when you get to the mode of passion, you do it just because it feels good. It may be the right thing, maybe the wrong thing. You may do what someone does in the mode of goodness, but it's not because you're in the mode of goodness. It's because you feel like it. And if you don't feel like it, you won't do it. And then when you come to the mode of goodness, it doesn't matter if you feel like it or you don't feel like it. You do it because it's right. That's it. Mode of goodness is simply, what did Krishna tell Arjuna? He said, fight for the sake of fighting. Because it's the right thing, not because you feel like it. So, Krishna told Arjuna, don't fight because it makes you happy, or don't run away because it'll make you sad. That's all about how you feel. It's total mode of passion. Well, first, it was mode of ignorance. I don't want to do anything. Then Krishna's coaxing him, and Arjuna's saying, no, I don't feel like it. It's not going to be good. That's complete mode of passion. So Krishna's saying, get to sattva. Sattva means do it because it's right. If you succeed, you fail. Doesn't matter. How many people won't do something because they won't succeed? I'm not going to do that. I'll fail. And Arjuna's saying, Krishna's saying, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if it makes you happy. Doesn't matter if you're victorious. Doesn't matter if you like it. You do it because it's dharma. That's sattva guna. So if we're not in sattva guna, we may know so many things, and it's just information. Right? Now there's a problem when you become a devotee. Because when you become a devotee, you start to learn about so many things you should do. And you know what happens when you don't do them? How does it make you feel? Not so good. Right? I know I should, but it's not a good feeling. And if you become a devotee and you read Bhagavatam, Gita, Chaitanya Charitamrita, you'll have so many I know I shoulds. There's so many instructions. So, for a devotee, happiness is getting knowledge and executing it. And misery is getting knowledge and remaining either in passion or ignorance, with just this information in your head floating around, this is what I should do, but I'm not going to do it. Isn't it? Yes? Now, there's a problem in Kali Yuga. And I want to tell a story. It's one of the most amazing stories in the Bhagavatam about duty, and it's Maharaj Priyavrata. Maharaj Priyavrata decided he would remain brahmachari. He didn't want to marry. And he was required, he was the only qualified person to become king. So he was asked to become king, and he said, no, I don't want to do it. I want to remain single. So then they couldn't find anybody, so Lord Brahma had to come. Because if Lord Brahma came, they knew he would be convinced. So Lord Brahma said, you have to do this. There's nobody. So if Lord Brahma asks you to do something, you'll probably do it. Won't you? Probably. So he said, okay, I'll do it. And then Prabhupada describes there something, it's quite incredible, and it's very difficult to relate to it for us in this day and age. He did not want to marry at all. He was completely detached. Did not want to marry, and he did not want to have children. And in the purport, Prabhupada says, he was a most affectionate father and a most affectionate husband. How do you become a most affectionate father and husband when you're completely detached? Right? We see in our movement, sometimes a brahmachari gets married. He never realized what marriage is, and then after a little while, he realizes this is not for me. And he has a really hard time doing it because by nature he's detached. And those marriages generally don't work. He's just too detached. And he can't really be there for the wife and kids. It's difficult. Anyway, we see that it's difficult. And most women, if you told them, we have a brahmachari here, we convinced him to marry you, he really doesn't want to get married, he actually wants to remain nice, sticky brahmachari, I don't think you'd say, that sounds like a good match. You'd probably say, well, I don't want to marry him if he doesn't want to marry me. Right? Wouldn't you? I would think. If I were a woman, I would. So here is Priyavrata Maharaj. Prabhupada says, ideal husband, affectionate husband, and affectionate father. Doesn't make any sense. Completely detached. Why? Because he took that role. This is my dharma, and he did it. It wasn't that I want to do it, I don't want to do it. He did it. And if it's I want to do it, I don't want to do it, that's passion. And if it's too much trouble, I'm not going to do it, that's ignorance. And if it's I'm doing it because it's the right thing, that's goodness. Right? So, Shastra Vidhim Utsrija Vartate Kamakarta. Krishna says, we give up Shastra. Why? Because we don't feel like following it. Krishna uses the word Vartate Kama Karta. And Prabhupada translates Kama Karta as whimsy. So what does whimsy mean? Hey Prabhu, want to go out on Sankirtan? Nah, I don't feel like it. What are you going to do? I don't know. I'll see how I feel. I grew up in L.A., so here's the conversation we had every Friday night. What do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? You had that conversation? Oh, I don't know. Let's go out and drive on Sunset Boulevard. That was what we did, you know. So it's all about what do you want to do? Where do you want to go on vacation? I don't know. Where do you want to go? Well, it'd be nice to go here. And it's all about how you feel, right? Isn't it? Everything's about feeling. Yashastra vidhim utsrija vartate kamakarta. We give up shastra injunction because we act whimsically. What does whimsically mean? Depends which way the wind's blowing today. That's where I go. I'm a free spirit. What are you going to do? If the wind blows me towards Venice Beach, I go. If it blows me towards San Diego, I go. If it blows me towards San Francisco, I'm a free spirit. Right? So this is what Prabhupada was dealing with us when we became devotees. Free spirits who didn't understand dharma. So, if you have knowledge but you're in passion and ignorance, still, if you're whimsical, then you can't follow. And in today's modern society, people don't act based on what they know. They act based on how they feel. Feeling's everything. You may know a million things, but what you feel is how you act. And our feeling as devotees is we feel to act as Prabhupada wants us to act. That's what we're supposed to feel. That's the position we're supposed to be in. So, what time is class end? 8:15? 8:30? Officially, what time? 8:15. So, when do we take questions? Like now or 8:15 we take questions? Or what? let's wrap it up here. So Kamsa is a very good example because he's always acting kind of how he feels, you know. He becomes repentant, so then that's how he acts. And then his advisors say, you idiot. You can't be repentant. You know, we have to do what we have to do. And he's like, yeah, that feels right. You know, it feels right to kill all these kids. So he's totally no intelligence. He's just acting on feeling. And so in Krishna consciousness, we're always battling with the lower feeling and the higher duty, what we're supposed to do. And I just read yesterday, Prabhupada said something interesting. He said, until you get to the stage of nista or ruchi, you're always going to be struggling. And it's just a reality we have to deal with. The body, the desires, the senses are going to say, go this way. And our intelligence has to say, go this way, do what's right. And Prabhupada said, you're going to struggle with it. It's just a reality. And you might say, when is it going to get easy? Well, when you come to Satvagun, when you come to nishta, when you come to ruchi, it'll get easy. How long is that going to take? I can't tell you, Prabhu. I can't tell you, Mataji. But all I can tell you is don't give up because someday you'll get there. And when you get there, you won't struggle anymore because you'll have taste. And your feeling will be aligned with your knowledge. Whatever you know, you'll feel. It won't be two different things. But now it's two different things. One thing we know, one thing we feel. Sometimes it's not the same, sometimes it is the same. That's conditioned state. So, Rupa Goswami, Utsaha Nishtaya Dharya Tattad Karma Pravartana. Why does he say that? Because Prabhupada's saying on the stage of Bhajana Kriya or Anartana Vritti, we're struggling. So what do you do when you struggle? You need determination and enthusiasm, right? Keep going. Oh, it's so hard, my mind and sense. Keep going, Prabhu. Keep going, Mataji. Just keep going. Someday, keep going, you're going to get a taste. Someday, you're not going to want to put your beads down. Someday, they're going to have to pull you out of your room to do service because you're reading Bhagavatam, you can't put it down. That'll come if you struggle through all the lower stages. All the feel, I don't feel like it. I don't want to do it. Yes? Yeah. So, I'll end with a very classic letter instruction by Prabhupada to one of our godbrothers. And he wanted to leave his wife. And Prabhupada said, you had no idea what you were doing when you were getting married. And he said, and now you want to leave, you have no idea what you're doing. So he said, this is not Krishna consciousness, that I do something and then I don't like it, doesn't feel good, and then I just give it up. Oh, let's take sannyas. So that's not Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness is steady, responsible, don't be whimsical. And when you... Okay, this is a really good story. We'll end with the icing story. At least I found this story amazing. We have one of our god sisters, some of you may know, Rasagya. And Rasagya was married to Loitaksha. And I was living in Vrindavan in the late 90s, and Loitaksha had gotten liver cancer. And they were no longer married, but she felt that as his ex-wife, it would be proper that she accompany him to Vrindavan. And he only lived about a week after he arrived. So she accompanied him, and I had been living in Texas part of the year, and she was living in Texas, so I got to know her. Sometimes I would visit Austin where she lived, and I would stay in her home with her. She had a boyfriend at that point. They weren't married, but they were living together. And so she brought Loitaksha. He died in about a week. And then right after he died, she said something that made a huge impression on me. She said, I should have never left Loitaksha. I should have never left him. She said, I was so stupid. And that's all she said. But in my mind, I heard something. I heard Dharma. I heard her say, if I would have done my Dharma, I would have been better off today. The Dharma would have been difficult. I wouldn't have liked it. It would have been a difficult marriage, but I would be more Krishna conscious today. She was speaking Dharma. I could feel it in my whole body that she's saying, I should have done my Dharma. Because if I would have done my Dharma, today I would be better off. I left him, I went and married another man, and she was remorseful. She did what felt right, felt good, but in her remorse, she was saying, I should have done my Dharma, I would have been better off. And it made this huge impression on me, that it's not about what feels good, that doesn't make us happy, but Dharma is what makes you happy. You do the right thing, you'll be happy. That's just how it is. And you'll be happy because you'll advance, and you'll come to the stage of Ruchi. When you come to Ruchi, everything in Krishna consciousness is easy. Everything is tasteful. Everything is relishable. What more could you want than that? What to speak of bhav and prema, where you're feeling ecstasy at every moment. So I'll stop here. Thank you for listening. And if you have any questions or comments on... Yes? Resentful. Because? There's something that's taught in the Bhagavatam. And it's hard. It's not a way anybody thinks. Intuitively, nobody thinks this way. And I'm going to tell you what it is. And just... you're going to have to meditate on it because it's very heavy. When something like this happens to us, our immediate reaction is, why? I don't deserve it. Is there a God? If there is a God, why would he do this to me? It's so many times things happen to us, just little things, and we think, what did I do to deserve this? Bhagavatam says, when you're a devotee, you should think, and this is very unusual, and no one in the world thinks this way. Instead of thinking, what did I do to deserve this? You're supposed to think, I deserve so much worse than this. That's how you're supposed to think. I have been so sinful, I've committed so many sins, that who knows really what I deserve? That's one thought. You got to meditate on that. You've got to digest it. That's the Bhagavatam. If something bad happens, what is our immediate instinctive reaction? To pray to Krishna to change it so it's not bad. I'm sick, pray to be healthy. You're sick, I pray for you. I don't have any money, pray for money. My knee hurts, pray that it's healed. That's natural, that's instinctive. It's not wrong in and of itself, but there's a higher consciousness. And when a devotee is on a higher level, he doesn't pray to change it. He thinks, Krishna, thank you. It should have been worse. Is that amazing? I mean, that's like, isn't that incredible? Who instinctively thinks that way? There's a situation, Krishna, please change it. No, Krishna, thank you. I deserve worse. The other way of thinking is that within every difficulty comes power. When you can reconcile this, that there's something that you had to go through in this life, or that person has to go through, because of some attachment or some impurity, they had to go through this. And if they go through it well and they learn from it, they'll become stronger. Do you know that some of the greatest, strongest people are the people who've gone through the most difficulties? You know that some of the most popular writers and psychologists are the ones that had the worst childhoods? Because they had to deal with that. They had to figure out how to deal with it. And in dealing with it, they became stronger. Just like, I do counseling, so sometimes we'll find a child who's been molested when they grow up. And that's like, they can't figure that out. It doesn't make any sense. There's nothing that makes sense out of it. And emotionally, it's destructive. And all I tell them is, try to think what this means. You know, why this is happening. And a lot of them come to the point where they realize, I think I'm meant to help other people that are in this situation. I think I'm meant to heal myself from the trauma that I've been through so I can be an aid to all the other children who go through this. That's what they realize. So, you know, I think one thing that's important to understand is when something happens, you develop a perspective. So let's say the perspective is resentment. You always have to ask yourself the question, what else could this mean? Because you're giving one meaning to it. What else could it mean? So when you hear from the sadhu, you get another meaning. Or you hear from many devotees, you get many meanings. It could mean so many things. It could be a blessing in some way. How? I can't say. That would be for you to meditate on. And you might realize, in some way, it was actually a blessing. Okay, I'll give you my story. I didn't have any problem when I was raised near here, in a nice neighborhood, with a lot of money, and everything was great. No crime, and no divorce. And everything was perfect. And two of my friends died from overdoses of heroin, because they had so much money in their family, they could afford to buy all the heroin they wanted, and one day, within like 6 months, they both killed themselves. So, what's the perfect situation? The perfect family. Yes?
I was very fascinated because you were exploring Kamsa's relationship to the Vedic Dharma.
Yes.
And how these, in the midst, now we know that in the case of Bali Maharaj, the Sukracharya, Sukra meaning the physical lineage rather than developing yeah. people to go back to Godhead, that Sukracharya guides people how to use the Vedic culture to advance their material kingdoms and lineages, etc., which in a sense does not seem that it leads down to the lineages of Europe, where all they cared about was physical lineage and nothing very much about Dharma. So how did that work in the case of Kamsa and his killing of his nephews? And how did that work out in the case of Kamsa from that sense of using the Vedic culture to advance himself as much as possible?
Got him killed. Well, the interesting point is, like, Veda doesn't mean that you're godly necessarily. So he was. It didn't have any effect on him. It didn't make him Krishna. He was Krishna conscious in the wrong way, but it just furthered his demoniac nature. It facilitated his demoniac nature. It was a better way to facilitate his demoniac nature. It's like we heard that Hitler was interested in Vedas. So, you know, it was a good way to further his mission. So, was that what you're... Maybe I didn't understand your question. Was that kind of what you were asking? Or I think any... The point is... No, it's a good point you make. The point is, according to your bhava, your nature, whatever information you'll get, you'll use it to further whatever it is your outcome that you desire. And I heard this interesting thing from Bhakta Steve, a Bhakta Kavi, you know, Stephen Covey. He said that for hundreds of years in the world of self-development, people would teach that you should be good because good is right. You should be kind because it's right. You should be compassionate because it's right. And he said about 50 years ago, they started teaching you should be good because if you're good, you'll make more money. You should be kind because if you're kind, people will like you and you'll make more money. He said the whole thing changed. So the same principles now, what's the point of the principles? To move you ahead, not because it's the right thing to do, it's because what you want. So use good principles. You can use sattvic principles for demoniac purposes. And then you get pulled down in the mode of ignorance. So that's what those kings did. So, you know, they knew the Vedas, and, you know, they were more efficient because they knew, use the Vedas, they're better. They'll get you what you want. And then our position as devotees is saying, okay, now what's your motive? Because motive's everything. It's like if you do the right thing and the wrong motive, what's the point? Better do the wrong thing with the right motive. Better feed Krishna banana peels in ecstasy than be Duryodhan and feed him a banana split and he doesn't want it because you're a demon. Right? So, you know, the ideal, do the right thing the right way for the right reason. But if you can't do the right thing in the right way, or you can't do the right thing, do whatever you're doing for the right reason. And Krishna will appreciate it. And they're doing the right thing for the wrong reason. So they get more entangled. Kamsa is a very interesting fellow. You can learn a lot from him. How he's so, you know, you can't trust him. So Shastra says you can't trust somebody if they don't control their senses. You can't trust him because at a moment's notice he'd just flip. And so many people are like that because when you're self-centered, it's all about what makes you feel good, what do you want. And you can change people very easily. So where is integrity in this age? I said it, I'll do it. When we heard that in the early part of the century, businessmen didn't have contracts, they had handshakes, they didn't need contracts. They said, this is the deal, and they shook their hand. And that was it. Your word was as good as gold. Now you have contracts and people break them. What's the use of a contract? It's not taken seriously. So that's what's going on. Yes.
Thank you, Prabhu Mahatma. In one purport, Srila Prabhupada mentions that Krishna gave Kamsa a little bit, like a little spark of that he reflected in something. He became like conscious.
For a moment.
And then when he went back to his friends, he became demon, as we know. Let's suppose that he hang on a little bit more in that stage, and we will have to bring him to the ISKCON movement now, the world we live in, and stay a little bit longer for 3, 5, 10 years, because of his demonic nature within him, he will create a lot of havoc. Because you will,
so if Kamsa wants to join ISKCON, don't let him. Okay, this is a very interesting point. Because Prabhupada had his doors open for everybody.
Yeah.
But occasionally some people created havoc.
Yes.
You want to hear an interesting statistic? That a company will make more money by firing a bad... They'll make 6 times more money by firing a bad person than they will by hiring a good person. So you get the best person you can, hire them. Your company will make more money. But if you find the person that's disrupting your company and you fire them, you'll make 6 times more money than you would by hiring that person. So this is an interesting question. I thought about it also, because companies now are very careful about who they hire, because they want to hire people that fit within the same consciousness and the same mission and goals of the company. So they get qualified people and they don't hire them, because they can tell these people won't work well. Can we actually do that in ISKCON? I'm not going to answer that question, but it's something to think about.
If you allow me to have a separate question.
Yes, yes.
Another one,
want to comment on that?
No.
Anybody want to comment on that? It's an interesting point, because this is Mahaprabhu's movement. How can you turn anyone away? But you might... Yes, Nagnapatni, you have a comment on that?
I was just reading something recently, is that we really can't compare ISKCON to a material society, to a material situation, and that this process is purifying in itself. So that if someone actually takes it seriously, no matter how demoniac their nature is, they can become purified. That
even
was the
Kamsa.
Whole mission of the
Chaitanya.
Well, he did
become purified as Jagai Madai, right?
Yeah. I'm a living example.
Yeah. So Kamsa, by the mercy of Mahaprabhu, becomes Jagai Madai, and then he joins the Hare Krishna movement, and then everything's great. Yeah, very good answer. Yes. We are merciful. We keep our doors open. But mercy hits a limit. So this one boy was stealing. They brought him to Prabhupada. Prabhupada said, okay, we forgive you. You steal one more time, we call the police. He went and stole again. Prabhupada called the police. So, you know, mercy has its limits. He had another question. Yeah.
The next question is doing things about how you feel.
Yes.
And then you gave a good explanation. So within a... organization, religious organization like ours, we measure the success of whatever little things you do changes in your life as a success if what we did, we become more attracted to Krishna, and then you say,
yes.
Fine.
Yes.
So then we have seen that also the other side of people who've been married maybe 2 or 3 times, and it looks so far that it's working better than what it was before. And the proof is that they become more enlightened, they're more like into Krishna as previously before. But in the other sense, we talk about Dharma.
Yeah,
then
giving up the Dharma.
It overlaps. He says, wait a minute.
Okay, it's a good question. So he's saying sometimes people do something that's not so dharmic, but it seems that they're more Krishna conscious. So when you add Krishna consciousness into the equation, sometimes things change a little bit. There was a man, he became a devotee. He was a professor. He was about 35. This was 1972. So in 1972, I was 22. So this guy was old. He was 35. He was like the oldest, you know, one of the older people in ISKCON. And you know, when you're 22 over 30, it's like you're just like an ancient being, you know. So, in Amala Bhakti, when he came, you were like, what, 35 or something? Or 40? Oh my God, Amala Bhakti was like senior, 40, 1975, right? You're 76. I was 26, he's 43. He was like, you know, prehistoric for me. So, this man asked Prabhupada what he should do, because his wife is not a devotee. She's feeding the kids meat. And Prabhupada said, he didn't give him an instruction. The only instruction was, do what's favorable for bhakti and avoid what's unfavorable. So that made a deep impression on me, because so many times, materially this is right, but it's going to ruin your bhakti. And so the answer always is, do what's favorable. Adjust your material situation in a way, as far as possible, is dharmic, but not at the cost of your Krishna consciousness. Because dharma is lower. Morality is lower than dharma. Then above morality, there's dharma, but above that, there's bhakti. But you have to be careful, because in the name of bhakti, you may do something sinful or wrong. So I think Prabhupada's attitude was, what's going to get you back to Godhead? At the same time, what is right? So, and then the third thing is, Prabhupada couldn't control us, always. So we were just going to do it anyway. So it's an equation that's going to be different for everybody. And I think Prabhupada wanted us to stick it out, ideally. But if that was causing us serious spiritual difficulty, then he would allow us to make adjustments. It's like you're putting all your energy into a losing situation. And let's say your wife's not becoming Krishna conscious, you're doing everything you can, you're not going out on book distribution anymore because you have to take care of this and that, or you're not making enough money. And, you know, the situations like that we might look at and say, it doesn't seem to be worth making this work now. Because even if I make it work, it's just, I think it's going to get worse anyway. Every situation will be different. Is that all right? Right?
Harder for the disruptors to participate, for example, you know. If disruptors are coming to the morning program, then if you were to lock up the restroom or something, then they're less likely to come, you know, inconvenience themselves. So.
That was a comment on what we were talking
about. You were asking.
About
ideas.
Not allowing people to come? Preventing Kamsa disruptors from becoming a devotee?
Yeah.
That conversation?
Yeah.
It's an interesting conversation. And once you let them in, it's hard to get them out. Prabhupada was merciful. And in retrospect, you know, Prabhupada did many things, and in retrospect, we kind of look at things and look at the pros and cons, and we make decisions now in 2016. You know, we want to be merciful. We want to give everyone an opportunity. And as Nagnapatni said, anyone can be purified, and that's testimony of that is Jagai and Madhai. But they surrendered, so the person has to surrender. If a person's surrendered and willing, then yes, we accept. Prabhupada accepts everyone who's willing. Prabhupada only rejected two devotees because they weren't willing. He never rejected anybody. You do any nonsense you want, if you came back and said, Prabhupada, I want to surrender, he immediately accepts you. But only if you wouldn't accept Prabhupada, they say, then what can I do? Do whatever you want. Two disciples, Prabhupada blessed them, do whatever you want. When your guru says do whatever you want, you know what that means? You're rejected. Because the guru has to guide you with his instruction. If he can't guide you with his instruction, he says do whatever you want. That means I'm not your guru. And so Prabhupada did that with two devotees. But everyone else, no matter how fallen they were, if they came back, Prabhupada accepted them. That's Mahaprabhu's mercy. Always accepted, unlimitedly. If you want to be Krishna conscious, I accept you. Right? So that's the same. We have to do the same thing. But if somebody doesn't want, what can you do? And then Prabhupada said, then what can I do? Do whatever you want. They were arguing with Prabhupada. Don't argue with your guru. Amrish Prabhu told a story. I was watching the Alachua Vyas Puja. And he was in Hawaii and he wanted to go to the restaurant. There were Govinda's restaurant just opened. He said, Prabhupada, can I go to the restaurant? Prabhupada said, we don't eat at restaurants. And then Amrish was a new devotee. He said, no, Prabhupada, you don't understand. Which is, you don't want to say that to your spiritual master. And he said that. And Prabhupada said, we don't eat in restaurants. You don't want to disagree with your spiritual master. Even you're trying to explain it's a Hare Krishna restaurant. And no, you just don't argue. Yes, Prabhupada, I won't go. Yes? That's disciple. Yeah. Okay, we should end? No? One question. One, and then we'll end.
Thank you.
If you have any more questions, you can ask me personally. Yeah.
Thank you for a wonderful class. I just wanted to check. Since you have been speaking about devotees also, one of the things devotees have is this comfort level. You know, they want to do service, but they want to do service within a perimeter of comfort level. Obviously, we know that Prabhupada left all his comfort levels and came to America.